Everybody, I'm Alex. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 21st, 1993. I have a sponsor. I've had the same sponsor since I was 4 or 5 months sober, something 3 or 4 months sober. My sponsor guy is an Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm only here not just to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous, but because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't, dead, jail, whatever it would be. Without AA, I would not be able to stand here. I'm really, really thankful for that. Thanks, Dale and the group for asking me to come up, and Gary for giving me a lift. I tried the hitchhiking thing in the cul-de-sac. It's not cul-de-sac and hitchhiking. I did quite a bit of hitchhiking, actually, a long time ago, but. I'm glad to be here. What a beautiful day. So I think I said my sobriety date's April 21st, 1993. I just turned 58 years old. I got sober when I was 28, and I first came to AA when I was 24. So it took me about 3.5 years or so to begin to stay sober. And what that looked like for me, the ages of 24 and whatever months to 28, was coming into AA meetings. And I went here because of a judge, or came here because of a judge. The judge said, this will look, not the judge, the lawyer said, this will look good to the judge. And so I'm like, I'm on that, you know? So at 24 years old, I'm dropped off at my very first AA meeting by my mom. Because I had no driver's license, and I remember pulling around the back of the Huguenot Road Baptist Church, and I intuitively knew, and it sounds funny, but I did. It was kind of like where y'all were out here. There's a little bit of an overhang, only there wasn't two buildings, it was off a door, and it's just, they're kind of huddled and stuff like that. And I'm like, just let me out here. I don't want them to see mom dropping me off. Kill the image. Here comes the new guy. He's got an image. Those 3.5 years of coming in and at AA meetings, there's no chance I stayed sober even approaching 30 days. It might be a day, it might be a week, it might be a couple of weeks of not drinking. And then I was drunk again, and I was okay coming here. I was nervous, I was uncomfortable, but I didn't feel uncomfortable while I was here. And people were extremely nice, but once I drank, I was gone till I was back. And that happened over and over and over again during that time period. It's funny because I just turned 30 years sober, and I couldn't imagine being 30 years sober when I got to AA. I couldn't imagine it at 5 years or 10 years. It seems like, some of the old tape decks that had the extra fast forward and the extra rewind, that's what it's felt like. Like somebody has just pressed one of those buttons and it's, just gone by like lightning. And, but I couldn't have imagined doing that, and it's, I think about sitting and listening to speakers or being at a meeting and listening to people share, way back when, or if I'm newer or newish or coming back or whatever it is. And, it's like, I look at somebody like that and say, oh my God, this person's sober this long. They must be like really awesome, right? And, there's plenty of days. I don't feel new anymore because I've been here a long time and I've gotten older, but I don't feel like 30 years sober all the time. And I don't behave like 30 years sober all the time. I don't react 30 years sober all the time. It's just, I'm thankful for it, believe me, but I've always got growing to do, and I've always got room to improve. I've always, in spades at times, and especially if you have kids, it's, the defects are on the surface plenty of the time. Anyhow, so uh, I uh, I grew up in a pretty normal family. I had one sister, 3 years younger than what, still my sister, Betsy, 3 years younger than I am. Not an alcoholic. Parents weren't alcoholics. They're both deceased. We lived in Richmond from 73 on, and a nice neighborhood, went to pretty good schools. I wasn't pampered or anything like that, but I would say we're just, you know, kind of middle class, middle of the road stuff. Dad was gone a lot growing up because he traveled in sales. He did a lot of different things, but that's what he was doing then. And mom kind of ran the house, you know, and she was sort of soft. Dad, you didn't want to have to talk to him, but there wasn't any conflict in the house growing up. There wasn't any bad stuff in the house growing up. There wasn't any, any bad example for me about alcoholism or really poor behavior. My parents were rock solid parents. They weren't perfect, but they were great examples for me. And my sister was and is probably a better person than I am, right? So I was the tornado in my family. And, I can't tell you, and I believe it, and I don't like this identification with it, but, I don't remember not feeling a part of the neighborhood kids group. I don't remember not fitting in. I don't remember, I'm not saying I did that stuff in spades, but I just don't remember feeling separated from my friends and stuff like that. Now, things I did realize was there were other kids that had more than I did. There were other kids that did more than I did. You know, there were other kids that were more popular than I, you know, that kind of stuff. But I think a lot of that's just normal. Sips of stuff growing up, the first time I remember feeling the effects of alcohol was probably junior high school. I was up at up the street, good ways up the street, two brothers, single mom. You know, we'd go up there and listen to albums all the time. They had one of those all-in-one stereos, you know, and so if we had 8-tracks or we had cassettes or we had albums, we could play it all. You know, an off-brand, not like, you know, Pioneer, Kenwood, or something. Something they bought at the back of the gas station, maybe. But we were up there listening to music, and somehow, I don't know whose idea it was, there was some whiskey underneath the kitchen sink, and we got into that. And I think we mixed it with iced tea in these big, hard plastic cups. And I don't remember feeling drunk. I don't remember feeling like some super effect or like the stars all lit up and that kind of thing. What I remember about that probably late afternoon was that we were doing something we weren't supposed to, which was a big plus back then. And we were getting away with it. We weren't going to be caught. The taste, I could take it or leave it. I wasn't repulsed by it. I wasn't attracted to it. But I remember one thing, the two brothers, one of them was kind of in line with me. We were just going to drink this and see what happened. And the other one detested how it tasted. And we caught him pouring his out in the sink. And my thought was, I don't know. There wasn't enough, or maybe we emptied the bottle or we can't take anymore, whatever it was. But my thought was, you know, we had no more reserve. We can't go back. We could have had that. Why did you pour that out? We could have had that, you know? And I remember that distinctly. And so you fast forward a little bit from there. And, I didn't start going buck wild in junior high school. There were a couple of, small little drinks here and there, nothing to write home about. But when I got to high school, I don't remember much in ninth grade, to be honest with you. But when I got to 10th grade, I had started to run in track and cross country and that kind of thing. And my coach hauled me onto the team and I had some talent, blah, 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 blah. this all came with an instant group of friends, a bunch of them, that I was with all the time. And back then the drinking age was 18. And there was parties at different people's houses all the time. And, you know, it was Judson's house for the keg party. His dad owned a sub shop. We could get kegs from there, from Bernie's, and bring them over. Or, you know, somebody's parents are out of town in Stonehenge or whatever. It was just, it was all over the place, you know. And with the Legion Hall, we're going to have a big party in the band and all this kind of stuff. And the drinking just started. And I didn't give any thought to, should I be doing this? Should I not be doing this? In my mind, and I would continue this thought for a long time, everybody else is doing it. And there were a lot of people doing it. But, you know, we just, you know, it was 4, 5, 6 beers, keg cups or whatever it was. And that was fine. I don't remember a whole lot of stories about people getting in a whole lot of trouble. I don't remember a whole lot of car accidents or injuries or anything like that. It was just how we were doing things on the weekends and that kind of thing. You know, I really enjoyed running a lot, and I became not really good, but became pretty good. And that was important to me. It was really important to me. And when I got to the end of high school, this is indicative of a lot of things in my life. I had no plan. It wasn't like, I'm going to go to college or I'm going to go. Now, my dad had a couple of degrees. He was in Korea, you know, all this other stuff. And he's like, don't tell me where you're going to go to school, you know? And I'm like, okay. You know, so I'm filling out applications and stuff. And I had started to develop a little, not with my dad, but I had started, not in front of him anyway. I just started to develop an air of just defiance. And it was more like behind your back stuff, you know, kind of thing. And, but he was like, this is, you know, do this. And so I filled out applications. I had become less interested in academics and that kind of thing. So I couldn't get into where I decided that I wanted to go. You know, I treated it not getting in like it was the dream school where I always wanted to go. I never wanted to go anywhere. You know, it was just just more stuff out of my mouth and my attitude. But I did get in. I did get into school nearby there, separated by Price's Fork Road. So you'll figure that out. It was awesome. You know, I mean, I went from getting out of high school and, you know, we did the beach week thing and we were out of control and drank like crazy people and all that other stuff. But there was always parents around. There was always something, you know, they were kind of liberal in the way that they approached things, but there was always an eye, you know, that Alan Parsons' eye in the sky. You always felt like there was an eye in the sky or the possibility of it. And then I got to college and it was like, I had walked into, you know, surround sound or Technicolor or something. I mean, it was unbelievable. It's like when, you know, I can go across the hall and do this. I can go down to the next wing and do that. I can, you know, it was complete freedom. And, you know, I can look back and see where my drinking really escalated between, it would have been on its way anyway, but this is where it happened in my story, is when I went from high school to college. It was just, you know, the less restrictions that I have, the more I'm going to mess up. And so, you know, that's what I did. And I was throwing some stuff out real recently. And I came across some of my old college transcripts. And I'm like, all right, okay, suspended. So I know I was at least suspended twice from Radford, right? Okay, so I hadn't had enough, so I went back and got suspended again. But to look at the collection of grades from the second suspension, it, you know, there's more W's and there's an eye in there. I didn't know you could get incomplete. I guess I was supposed to turn something in and I never, you know, it was just, it, the first one was messy. The second one was messier, you know, kind of thing. But it, that's really what happened. I mean, it was just, I mean, it was just, I treated it like one big party, you know. I started blacking out a lot. I don't know. I don't remember like the first time I blacked out. I don't remember doing a lot of that in high school. And it didn't really seem abnormal to me. I don't remember being alarmed by it, you know, or any of that other stuff. And I was telling Gary, I found a charge slip that an RA had given me. I had to go before the judicial board. We had a fire alarm. I lived in a 13-story dorm with five wings off the side. So it was a lot of people. And we all had to come out of there from this fire alarm in the middle of the night. And I was in a blackout the entire time. I mean, the entire time. I wake up and here's this charge slip. Well, I'm throwing the stuff out, you know, public intoxication, verbal abuse, you know, all this other stuff. And it's like, I can't repeat. The guy actually quoted the things that I said to him. And, you know, Radford in the winter is not a warm place. So I was complaining about some things, you know, but I mean, that didn't seem abnormal to me, you know. If you laughed, I was kind of proud of it. If you didn't say anything, it didn't matter, you know, and there wasn't a lot of disapproval coming about it. And, you know, I wouldn't call it my first drinking consequence, but my first really significant drinking consequence came in college when one of my suite mates or hall mates, he was from Richmond too, and we were both dating girls in Waynesboro. So when we would come back to Richmond for like, you know, Thanksgiving break or whatever, we would go to some bar, might be Daryl's on the Lothian, might be pizza place's sister, would get tanked up, let's drive to Waynesboro. And I woke up behind Ladd Elementary School one morning. I don't even remember even getting there, you know, but this time we made it up, but we didn't make it back. And I wasn't driving. And it was a Chevette. We hit a guardrail on 64, flipped over, hit a tree. You know, his parents took us by the junkyard on the way back to school after break. And, you know, the whole front end was caved in. And you could see where I went into the dashboard on the I hit the dashboard, but into the windshield on the drive passenger side. And I think it was said to me, but I can't verify now. But I remember having the thought or someone saying to me, if you hadn't been drunk, it wasn't wearing a seatbelt. If you hadn't been drunk, you'd be dead. And I'm like, you know, all of a sudden that became my ally. Hey, man, I'd be dead if I wasn't drinking. You know, I mean, that's really kind of twisted. I mean, there's some humor to it, but it's completely twisted, you know. And so I would roll on through stuff like that, like it was nothing. And that was, you know, pretty serious. I mean, I was kind of out for 3 days. Woke up in my bed with my sister and her friends checking on me. You know, where was the last 3 days we've been out? Kind of thing. Just on by that. You know, there's a lot of things that I did during that time period that are not, you know, appropriate to talk about from the podium, but it was the kind of stuff I started weighting myself down with, right? As I was moving forward, not a missed opportunity or I forgot to buy a birthday present or just some pretty horrible stuff, you know? And I didn't know that was working on me. I didn't care at the time, you know, but I couldn't erase it. So I'm, you know, starting to fail out of school, get suspended, trying to go back. This is the whole game I would play for the next handful of years, right? I mean, I'd come back from there. All right, I'm never going back. Screw them. You know, kind of stuff. Get out of here. And I would bounce around apartments in Richmond, did a couple stints in the Fan, you know, I'd, you know, live with somebody for a little while till I couldn't pay the rent. I'd kick out the plate glass window in the front. I'd do, you know, just crap like that. I mean, just, and I would hold just a bunch of different odd jobs. I had no, you know, I had no, I don't even like the word, but I had no aspirations. I had no plan. I had nothing I really wanted to do other than drink and get away with whatever I was trying to get away with. And, you know, my family's watching all this stuff, and I treated their house like a rest area. You know, they never gave up on me, and they weren't really overly, it's not like they were handing me 50s every time I came in there. I mean, they had rules and they did this and they did that, but they always gave me an opportunity, I guess is the easiest way to say it. And, you know, I wasn't, when I would be, you know, pull into the rest area again, or, you know, have to leave that next other apartment or whatever it was, or get fired from a job or walk out, you know, I didn't get fired from every job. I walked out of one or two of them, and I felt good too, especially with what I had to say as I was walking out. You know, I just can't fathom doing that today, you know, but, I mean, this stuff just continued, you know, and I would try to go back to school and alcohol would get in the way. You know, I can remember taking an econ class at VCU, big auditorium class, probably, I'm sure they're bigger now, but like 100, 125 people, right? And I'm on this side and I'm looking over, hey man, that's Joe from high school. Bradham was his last name, it doesn't matter. I don't think he's an AA. But I'm like, man, yeah. And it's like, hey, you know, I'm making the name up because I don't know. Smith's Bar has a CD jukebox. Are you kidding? Yeah, and happy hour starts right at our break because it was a Tuesday, Thursday class. Right. So that's what that, you know, it constantly taking over everything I started to attempt to do. And, you know, all I did was learn to withdraw. You know, so it was just a lot of in and out of that stuff. And in June of 1989, I think it was June of 89. Yeah. June 11th, I think, of 1989. I'd been drinking all day at a remember those apartment parties where the apartments were like cool with everything and they actually promoted some of it. You know, it wasn't like two apartments took over and offended everybody. Everybody was involved. So it was, you know, very little control or rules. So I'd been drinking all day at that. Got dropped off at the rest area and I wasn't done drinking. And, you know, I was going to head over to Brian's house for this next party that night. And you know, probably interested in some girl because I wouldn't probably normally go that far out. But I hopped in. My dad had an old pickup truck that used to be, it was a Chewy Supply Company truck from Buena Vista, 1970 Ford F-100, 3 on the tree, no interior heat, no radio, no power steering. And it was hand painted in primer, had overload springs on it, and the little wooden rails and stuff. So I hop in that thing and I'm taking beers with me. And I don't, you know, I probably make it about a mile and a half from my house. And the cops are behind me. And I got pulled over, and the cop was trying to give me a field sobriety test. And, it was on a little stretch of road that is, I don't want to spend too much time talking about this, but he got me up in the parking lot of a business, and the parking lot had a slant to it, right? And he's telling me to, and I'm like, the parking lot, it's slanted. I can't walk. There's no wonder I'm failing the straight line, you know? Right? So he's like, fine. He gets me out. He's got his flashlight. He's ready for any kind of traffic. It's not a busy little section of the road. He's like, do it. And I couldn't do it. Right. And so he hauls me to jail, Chesterfield County. And they one arm handcuffed me to the metal railing seating. And I'm looking around as I'm in there, and I'm like, man, these guys are messed up. This guy has urinated all over himself. That guy's not even awake. I'm gonna be out of here, you know? And it was a long time before they even tested me. And I still blew it to a, I mean, it was at least 3 hours after I was arrested, because they have to charge you within a certain time frame. That was another resentment I got later, because my lawyer didn't even address that when we got to court. So I could have gotten out of it on that, but it was already done and over. But so they got me on that, and I had a walk home. It was a long way because I live in Bonnet. And, you know, it was just part of the price of doing business. Yeah, I hadn't been arrested yet, but now I had. So yeah, it's another little star or something, whatever you want to call it, story to tell people. And I didn't tell anybody that I'd been arrested. I think my parents were out of town or something. I didn't say anything to anybody. I think a friend or two. And so I did, as a court date got closer, I think it was early that fall or real late summer, you know, I started freaking out. Because I'm like, what am I going to do? I haven't told anybody. So I did the only logical thing I could think of, was leave town. So I did that. And that's where the hitchhiking comes in. You know, I had learned how to, not that you need to learn much, but I've learned some of the things about hitchhiking from going to, I was seeing this girl who went to college in Charleston. And my car broke down, so that's how I learned to do that. So I left town, and I was down through North Carolina and living with a guy in a trailer for a while in the middle of a field, and you know, just bumming off of people and stealing from them. Not so blatantly that they would throw me out, but eventually they find out. Get out of here, you know. And I finally came back, and all this other mess. And, you know, but what else was I going to do? I got to go home, and I got to ask for help. I screwed up again. This is big, you know. So they get the lawyer. The lawyer is like, it's going to be really cool if you go to an AA meeting. It's going to look great for the judge. And so I'm like, okay. And so I did that, told you about mom dropping me off and all that stuff. The, you know, when I went to court, they said I had to go to ASAP, which were these classes and stuff, and they show you films and movies and tell you not to do things, and somebody has cones and they hit them after they've been drinking in the, you know, massive parking lot that has no other cars in it, and, you know, that kind of stuff. But you had to go for an interview with them. I went in for the interview, and this young, attractive woman was interviewing me. I mean, she's probably fresh out of college, but I wasn't adding it up. I'm just like, man, she's nice looking. So I'm bringing my best stories to the interview. What an idiot. Oh yeah, we did this. You know, I'm not even exaggerating, you know. It's just, you know, she's so not only do I have ASAP, now I have extra counseling and additional counseling beyond. Yeah, I mean, it's funny, but it's the absolute truth. I mean, like, I'm thinking I'm going to be able to hook up with this girl if I give her my best stuff. You know, I mean, what a buffoon. Yeah. And so I went through all of that. I went to the AA meetings and what I had to. And there, I mean, people were very nice. I didn't feel at home. I didn't feel connected. I was nervous, and I didn't want to be there. But in a weird way, like I mentioned, there was some comfortability to being at the AV, but I did not feel like I had arrived at home at that point, you know. And so I'm in and out for those years. Things are getting, you know, mostly the same, and then sometimes worse. And, you know, I failed to mention, though, that I got brought up going to church, Presbyterian. And I went till I had the choice of whether or not I had to go anymore. And of course, I didn't want to go. You know, I was there every week, but I didn't hear a thing. And I didn't connect. I made no effort. It was just, you know, I got to show up. You know, it's like going to Aunt Liz's for dinner, you know, kind of thing. And you just tolerate it. And there wasn't anything difficult that I was asked to do at all. But I hadn't, I had developed zero relationship with any kind of God or higher power, even though I'd been introduced many times. You know, I saw the example of what my dad did for his community. I saw, he was also a coach. I saw the example of what my mom did in volunteering and in prayer. You know, I can't tell you the amount of times I intruded into her room looking for something, maybe money to steal that she'd hidden from me, or something out of their bathroom that I needed, whatever, toothpaste or something, Band-Aid, you know, and I'm not knocking, I'm just barreling in, and there's my mom on her knees by the bed praying, you know, and I'm sorry, you know, and that kind of thing. But it, nothing ever sunk in, nothing ever clicked, nothing, I didn't try to do anything, you know, and at the end of my drinking, the outside of my circumstances had never looked better. Okay. And there's a bunch of times I said to myself, if I've got a driver's license, if I've got time to run, if I've got a good job, if I've got a car, if I've got a place out of my parents' house, if all those things are in place, I'm not going to live like this anymore. Why would I? And I had all those things. And I'm sitting at a window in a nice apartment with a clock radio, drinking warm beer and smoking cigarettes, hiding from my roommate, Doug, who I went to high school with, who's in a wheelchair. And I had arranged my furniture so that he couldn't get all the way into my room. He could kind of open the door and kind of come in, but it would be impossible for him to move this dresser to get his chair all the way in to see everything that's going on. So, you know, I'm doing that kind of thing. And I'm thinking to myself, I've got all the stuff. I don't mean, I shouldn't say it like that, but these categories are taken care of. That was my criteria. And I'm still living like this, you know. And so I came back to AA again. And the last drunk was cheap beer and cocaine in that apartment. And 3 day drunk. I left an AA meeting on my birthday, April 17th, 1993, and went for 3 days and then came back. And I didn't know that day I came back was gonna be any different than any other time I'd been to AA. There was no other place for me to go. I had to have some kind of relief. I didn't realize AA was providing any relief, but yet I was drawn like, not a strong pull, but I was drawn like a magnetic pull back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I showed up, same church. I was dumb. I was just stupid, dumb. When I left AA meetings and drank, I would come back to the same meetings. I never put it together that you could go to different meetings. So I'd see some of the same people every time. There he is again. You know, they didn't say that. That's what I'm thinking they're going to say, you know. And so the embarrassment level was just a little bit higher, you know, but I get back in and Randy's, you know, white chips, and I hated that. Oh God, I hated that. And I got up and he's, you know, I don't know if he had him in a bag or something, but he's like, you know, they're out of white chips. And I'm standing there what feels like 15 minutes. And finally, he pulls a quarter out of his pocket. Gives it to me. And that was, I swear to God, and that was my white chip, you know? I didn't know that was going to be any different than any other time I'd been back to AA at all. And, you know, I didn't drink for longer than I hadn't drank, but it wasn't because I was doing anything different. You know, probably because I found a group of people that I was running around with drinking coffee till 3 o'clock in the morning and listening to loud music, you know, and going to the park and stuff like that. I did kind of group up with some people that was different than things I had done before. So that probably, you know, fellowshipped me for a little while. And I got to that point again where I always got to come a day. I know I'm going to drink again. And I never told the soul, I think I mentioned that. You know, I'm not going to tell you, you know, on April 17th of 1993, I'm not saying, hey, man, Sam, I'm going to drink tonight. Please help me. I'm not doing that. I don't even get up and leave the meeting. I sit through the whole meeting. And then I go to the Amoco at the corner of Hall Street, you know, and do that. But this time I sat through an AA meeting and I had been listening to this guy at this meeting. And I went to this meeting because I followed a girl there. She was like, it's a big book meeting. I said, I don't care about no big book. You know? And I did. I, at the time I could kick out. I've got to watch my language. Crazy big book. I don't care. You know, but it became big book meeting. Be around her. Big book. Okay, we'll go. You know, so I went and this guy kept sharing week after week. I'm not sure if he shared every week, but it wasn't that many weeks, but it just felt like it. And he was sharing stuff and it sounded a lot like my story, a lot like my story. And no, I didn't have in the back of my mind, you know, James told me I'm going to hear somebody tell my story. I don't remember these cliches or sayings or anything. I just remember listening to this guy. I'm like, oh my God, that's me. That's me. You know, so this, when I was getting ready to drink again and I knew I was gone, I mean, right after that meeting, I went up to this guy and it was 50.1 to 49.9. You know, it was that close of a call. I said, I need help. I said, I'm going to drink. And I don't know if I've ever done a first step or a second step. You know, he was in full authoritarian mood and position at that time, which is exactly what I need. I mean, I was all over the place. You know, I needed some structure and stuff, but he sat and talked to me for a while, became my sponsor. And, you know, took me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, got me involved. You know, he had requirements, be honest with you. I'm not saying probably did use the word. I don't remember exactly how he said it, but it's like, you got to have a home group. You have to, you know, you got to show up at these meetings. We're going to this conference. You know, I'm not very sober and I'm driving down to Jekyll Island, Georgia to go to a conference. I'm like, what am I doing? But man, it was awesome. You know, never would have picked it on my own. Never would have picked it on my own. But that process of asking for help and being willing to take the help as it was delivered made all the difference in the world for me. You know, I'd love to live, even to this day, without real guidelines, without real deadlines, without real responsibility, without, you know, it'll happen. It all may happen at the last minute, but it's going to happen, you know, and it just, that totally was a different way. His way was a completely different way of looking at things for me. I mean, that man saved my life. Could have been any one of y'all if you were there at that time and you knew about AA, but it was him, you know, and he absolutely saved my life. You know, the two points that I like to mention about going through the steps, I don't go through the steps when I talk, like here's what I did about saying anybody. I enjoy all types of people's doing their speaker thing, just not what I do. But there are two big points that I like to make. Number one is when I did my fifth step, and I think it kind of goes without saying, I'd never, ever, ever, ever attempted anything like doing a fourth step before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, come on, you know. I'm the guy who drags the book bag out to the third rock from Pony Pasture Park with the, you know, the case of beer. I'm writing poetry, baby, whatever. You know, I'm not doing an inventory. You know, but I did this inventory and I took it to him. And there were at least three things, I believe, that I hadn't written down. All out of the sex inventory. And, you know, I would, reluctantly isn't even the right word, I would with some shame and embarrassment, I would tell you that I embezzled from an employer, from an owner of a business, single guy, right? Stole from. And I felt bad about that. And that ended up getting cleaned up. But, I would tell you stuff like that. I would tell you that I screwed somebody over on something or another, or I stole this, or I did, I wasn't bragging about that when I said it, but I could get that out. This other stuff, not happening. Not a chance. No way. And so I hadn't written this down, and I sit down, and there's this commotion going on while I'm doing this fifth step with him in his house. Nothing was wrong. The pipes had burst. The animals are running through, the girlfriends, that, and it's not a big place. It's a little house at the time. It's my wife, kind of thing. But I sat down with him and finally got it out. And he said some stuff to me. I don't remember exactly what he said, but it completely opened the door for me to share with him the things that I had written down before we even started reading the other stuff. It's like, I didn't have this thought then, but I've had it now. How'd you know? I mean, this was all new to me back then, but I shared that stuff with him, and that stuff was never going to see the light of day. And that was a really important, the rest of it was important too, but that was really important because that was one of those no nevers, I took a knee and turned it over. And so that was just vital. And it wasn't long after that, I hadn't even noticed how, I'm not even sure what the right word is. Uncomfortable doesn't quite fit, but I wasn't completely comfortable in meetings and stuff. I mean, I like going and I felt better when I left, but I wasn't comfortable just sitting in a meeting, And after doing that fifth step, I wasn't instantly, I'm home, like I mentioned before, but I felt a lot better about being around y'all. I didn't realize it as that, but it just, there wasn't this separation, maybe, I guess. And lo and behold, I had done something in AA. I mean, everything up until that point, I'm kind of doing in private, if you will, or with one other person. And, I kind of let the cat out of the bag with this. So that was a really important thing. The other one was on amends. I had my idea of amends in a certain way with all the girlfriends first, the old girlfriends first, and I need to go back and clean this stuff up. And, if things go well, maybe we have a good time, right? And hope she's not seeing anybody, or it's not serious. And I mean, I say that for laughs, but it's the absolute truth. That's exactly how I thought. And sponsor got to look at that. Nope. And so this one in particular that I had that I genuinely owed amends to. I may not be able to make them, but I owed her big time. And it wasn't the worst thing in the world, but it was emotionally very poor and bad. So he goes, look, you just be, I felt like he was just kind of, let me put this in my pocket. We'll just look at that some other time. He said, you're just going to have to wait and see if the opportunity presents itself. Because I'd never experienced that. It just sounded like some kind of BS. You don't have an answer for me, do you, Spots? I mean, that's the stuff that's going on in my head. And so I said, okay. I mean, what was I going to do? And probably by that, who cares what the exact time, 6 years later, I'm sitting at home after Serenity Weekend. And I don't barge into this girl's life. And I'm sitting at home after the Serenity Weekend, and I get a phone call, and I'm going to tell the very short version of this part. But it turned out to be this girl calling me out of the blue. I mean, I don't know how many years it had been since I'd even talked to her. I knew she was married. I knew she had kids. Da, 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 da. And I'm going, oh, crap. She's talking a mile a minute. And I'm just like, you know, I can't call my sponsor. He's not going to answer the phone this late anyway. You know? Oh, yeah. Ask God. Pray and ask God what to do. You know? What do I do? You may not get another chance. You know, because I was trying to set up this time to see her. I'm like, you can bring your husband. Just can we meet for a cup of coffee? And she's like, what is this about? What did you? She wasn't angry. She just wanted to know. I mean, who wouldn't be curious about that? You know, and I told her, and she just laughed. She was like, we were kids. We were kids, you know. And then she proceeded to tell me about, you know, I was riding down the Midlothian Turnpike and gave her the double bird one time. And she was mad about that. But I could make amends for that if I want. You know, I'm like, I mean, but the big thing was not the big thing. You know, and that slate's clean. And I got, you know, I'm really, but how that all transpired, I thought my sponsor was full of crap. I'm never giving, you know, maybe I'll run into her at a show or something, but this isn't going to happen. And anyhow, so that was, you know, that was pretty neat. And it was my first experience of actually asking. I mean, I prayed just like my sponsor told me to do, but like that it came upon myself to do this prayer and ask for help and an answer. And I got it. Never had that happen before. I mean, it was remarkable. It was like magic. So anyway, that's the couple of step things that I like to mention. You know, I went on to get married in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, this is the suit that I bought for my honeymoon. Because we were going to a warm wedding, she's like, you gotta have a suit. And it still fits. Isn't that awesome? I had in it. I mean, that's 20, whatever years, 23 years old. Anyway, I thought Billy might be here, and I knew he could identify with 23-year-old suits. that was gonna be my joke. That was gonna be my joke for him. But I got married. I got married in AA, and that girl that drew me, attracted me to that meeting where I met my sponsor. And we stayed married for 14 years, had a kid who's 13 now. Her name's Valerie, a bunch of y'all know her. She's a great person. We're actually probably closer today in some ways than we were when we were married, which is really cool. And I'm pretty tight with her husband. She's remarried. But so we had the kid and, you know, went through the divorce. The divorce was the hardest thing I've ever gone through. Bar none in Alcoholics Anonymous, both parents dying, you know, feeling like I just want to leave this earth, you name it, the hardest thing hands down. It was drawn out. It was, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. It's just, I can't put it into words. It sucked bad. And, you know, I went to my sponsor and I'm like, you know, I wasn't employed at the time. I was being the manny. We had a nanny and then she left and she and I were working full time. And I'm like, I'll just quit my job and watch our son. And we had enough income to do that. It wasn't a big deal. I mean, we weren't rolling, but we could pull this off. And then, you know, boom. So I'm like unemployed. I'm, you know, now going to be getting divorced. And I'm like, I'm just totally screwed. I mean, it was absolutely the darkest period of my life. And I went to my sponsor. I did another inventory. Read it to him. I've done inventories before, but met him up at outside Whole Foods, sat in his vehicle, read it to him, did everything he asked me to do, go to different meetings, be ready to help somebody. Blah, 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 blah. And so I got through all that. But there was the negotiations of the divorce, right? And I had the opinion going into it. I said, there's no chance I'm going down as the defendant. Not going to happen. That was my big shtick. I am not going to be the defendant in this, right? I haven't done anything in my mind, right? And I mean, our marriage eroded because of a lot of different reasons, but you know, I'm to blame for a lot of things, and I got to see that later. But the surface stuff and the, you know, the attraction stuff and the rating stuff really wasn't. So I'm like, what, you know, did all this stuff he asked me to do, what do I do? Just, why don't you ask her what she wants? What? Are you kidding me? How do I win anything if I ask her what she wants? You know, I'm sure I didn't use those words, but that's what I meant. Right? And I'm not saying we had a lot of stuff. We did. But I had hired a lawyer, right? Given her a retainer. I got a female lawyer, right? Recommended. And he goes, just ask her what she wants. And I said, okay. And it was like shortly after that, I just surrendered to the whole thing. I said, I talked to her. I don't think she'd mind me sharing this. I've shared stuff like it before, but yeah. What do you need out of this? And I've just fired, unretained my lawyer. I got some of my deposit back. Here's half the money. Go buy yourself something. Don't spend it on your law stuff. Go do something for yourself. Yeah, you know, I was good. I mean, it was a slow process. She was seeing a guy who she's now married to. I hated his guts, bad, and you know, and that all over time and trying to practice these principles cleared up, and that kind of thing started with me. You know, they were living in an apartment. I stayed in the house, and we'd have Beck, my son, you know, dropping off, coming back, dropping off, coming back. That whole, and I talked to him, and he's a member of my home group, and he's actually sponsored by one of my sponsees. It all started with getting my son from him because Valerie couldn't be there, and shaking his hand in the parking lot of the apartment building, saying, "Thanks for looking after Beck. I appreciate it." It all started with that, you know, and God has just picked a completely different way for things to go than the way that I wanted them to go. You know, I love some revenge, folks. I love to see you hurting after you burned me. And I shouldn't say burned me, but harmed me or whatever my perception. You know, that was just absolutely huge. And there's no way that I ever could have produced something like that on my own, you know. And my son, and, you know, today, every Christmas, they have me over in the morning. I get a Christmas stocking, you know, I get a big cup of coffee. I can, you know, we're all doing this together, you know, and it's just, I see, been around AA a long time. I see a lot of other stuff, and I'm really, really thankful that I get to have that. The one other thing that I wanted to mention real quick, just about out of time, was that my former wife, Valerie, was diagnosed with cancer. And this is round two, and it's stage four. And we don't know what's going to happen. She's in the middle of chemotherapy right now for the second time. And, you know, it's in some ways, it's very frightening for, obviously, for her, but also for us, you know, for my son. She has a son from her first marriage, my stepson, and that kind of thing. But and her husband, Chris. It's just, it's not easy on any of them. And, you know, but the cool thing is, I call her about every day. And I say, hey, what's up? Just checking on you. Is there anything you need today? And, you know, and we talk all the time. And I'll call Chris and I'll say, how you doing? Is there anything you need today? You know, I don't have to worry as much about my son because we're together about 5 days a week and we talk a lot, and he's okay, you know, but I worry about them and this kind of thing. But the only way that I can deal with other than prayer and asking God for help is really kind of the impetus that's been given to me is to try to be useful to them if I can, rather than sitting in my own stuff about, you know, I'm not really thinking about me, but in a sideways way I am. right? You know, I am thinking about them. I love them. I love both of them. But it's like, it's still, it's not about me. You know, how can I be of use to them? But like I said, when I got up here, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no chance that I'd be here. There's no chance really that I would be breathing or breathing free. And every downtime I've had, every trouble time I've had, every difficulty that I've had has never been made worse by more AA. Thanks.